They were among the last of their kind. They'd survived for over 100 years after many, many others had died. But in the end, they too succumbed to the inescapable plague.
You can still see the skeletons or the ghosts. They are magnificent, even in their death, like just how big they were.
I'm Dylan Thuris, and this is Atlas Obscura, a celebration of the world's strange, incredible, and wondrous places. Today, we're diving into a kind of apocalypse, one you might not know about, but that radically altered the landscape of America. This is the story of the unimaginable destruction of the American chestnut tree, what was once known as the redwood of the East Coast. And it's the story of the group of scientists, academics, and tree lovers who are desperately trying to bring them back from the edge of extinction. That's after this. If you're looking for a place where the wide open skies and the towering mountains inspire you to find an untapped part of yourself, you might want to take a trip to Wyoming. It's a place where bold, curious spirits forge their own way on all types of adventures. There is no shortage of iconic, expansive landscapes out there. You can discover breathtaking hikes, stunning state parks, authentic Western culture, and other historic sites, along with the tales of famous outlaws like Butch Cassidy and pioneers like Buffalo Bill Cody. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
So the American chestnut tree, its scientific name is Castanea dentata, and the American chestnut tree was formerly one of the most prolific and arguably utilitarian tree throughout the Appalachian Mountains of the eastern United States.
That's Sarah Fitzsimmons, and she is the director of restoration for the American Chestnut Foundation. The American Chestnut Foundation works to save and restore this once beloved American chestnut tree. So what was the kind of environment that they were in?
There was a farmer from central Pennsylvania, stuck 9 chestnut seeds in their pockets, you know, went to settle west, ended up in western Wisconsin, and planted these chestnut seeds in the ground. Those 9 trees would eventually go on to be upwards of 30 acres. An explorer named DeSoto, who was quoted as saying that where there be mountains, there be chestnuts. And that's pretty true.
Wood from American chestnut trees was used in everything from furniture to telephone poles to fence posts. And the chestnuts themselves were an important food source for both animals and humans.
There's a reason that we have a song at Christmas time, chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
It was a tradition for the elite and dignitaries of the 1800s to bring chestnuts back for holiday celebration. They traveled into the mountains of upstate New York or western Connecticut to gather and harvest them. Such a wonderful pastime, until the American chestnut slowly approached its perilous demise. Even though America had its own native chestnut trees, people were always looking for the next best thing. And they began importing chestnut trees from other parts of the world. One of these trees was the Japanese chestnut tree. And it's a beautiful tree, but its striking beauty camouflaged something else: dangerous pests and pathogens that crept in with the Japanese chestnut and began infecting chestnut trees.
People started saying, hey, my American chestnuts are dying, and I don't know why. In 1904, there was a zoologist at the Bronx Zoo in New York City, of all places, and he saw this orange cankered thing on the American chestnuts that they had on property, isolated it, put it into a petri dish, recognized that it was a fungal organism. So while the pathogen had been in the U.S. Killing trees prior to that, we kind of used that 1904 date as, you know, when we knew what it was, when we knew what was attacking the species. And by 1950, virtually every mature tree in the eastern U.S. had been eliminated.
How does the the fungus actually kill the chestnut tree? What does it do to it that, that causes it to die?
The chestnut blight fungus is what's called a necrotroph.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good right off the bat.
right off the bat, this is bad news. The chestnut blight fungus exudes what's called oxalic acid ahead of its mycelium. That kills the chestnut tree cells. And then the mycelium, you know, however they eat, you know, slurps up the chestnutty goodness from those dead cells.
This is diabolical.
Yeah, right? but I mean, if you're a fungus, that's perfect.
It's ingenious. You've gotten a huge meal and then given yourself like a permanent snack system.
For the fungus, it's the perfect scenario. But what more could you ask for?
In the 50 years since the pathogen was introduced, the chestnut blight devastated the American chestnut population. The pathogen was windborne, it was insect-borne, and it was waterborne. It had ample opportunity to ignite and perpetuate this devastating pandemic.
Did any survive?
Good question. There are American chestnuts. There are mature American chestnuts that have not been marred by the chestnut blight, and they are in Oregon and Washington and California. There's sort of two classes of mature American chestnut that you can see on the East Coast. There's isolated, unmarked American chestnuts that grow to about 25 inches in diameter that have no blight, and they're lucky. The second category are trees that are large and are surviving with the blight. And these are ugly. They show battle scars up and down their entire trunk. And they basically look like if a tree got scabs all the way up and down the trunk, and because that's effectively what it is this, these individuals have resistance. They are able to fight off the fungus to live. It ain't pretty, but they're alive.
These are like the sole survivors of a zombie apocalypse.
Yes.
you know, this whole thing has like slightly the outlines of like a horror movie, because there's this horrific fungal blight that comes in. Necrotroph. Necrotroph. And you end up with basically the survivors are either irradiated mutants or these kind of like, you know, battle scarred, hardened, like completely, you know, roughed up trees. And it's got sort of some of these, I don't know, apocalyptic tropes to the whole thing.
I hear you. I agree. I love that visual, because it really is true. Just spread across 180 million acres of landscape. I think, you know, taking into account the scale of it, it makes it almost even more amazing.
People have tried a lot of different things to end this attack on the American chestnut and slay this zombie fungus once and for all.
So people tried, fungicides, of course. That was one of the first things tried. None of that worked. People tried cutting out large swaths of dead American chestnuts, creating and living chestnuts ahead of that, like a fire break to try and keep the fungus from spreading. Well, that didn't work. It was at that time that the USDA sent Frank Meyer of Meyer Lemon fame over to China to get Chinese chestnuts. Well, let's replace American chestnuts with Chinese chestnuts. Well, that didn't work for various reasons. A couple of other agencies tried breeding American chestnuts and Chinese chestnuts in various ways to get a mostly American chestnut with blight resistance, and none of that worked.
Trial after trial, error after error, nothing seemed to work until a small glimmer of hope started to peer through.
In the 80s, a plant breeder at the University of Minnesota, Charles Burnham, thought, well, let's try different plant breeding techniques. And he thought about back cross breeding specifically. And that's what started the American Chestnut Foundation, was to basically work on this hypothesis that six generations of hybridization and back crossing and then intercrossing would create a blight resistant American chestnut.
It's been a tougher nut to crack than they'd initially hoped. After decades and decades of work, the organization has been able to breed American chestnuts that are moderately resistant to the fungus, but still not totally.
what would success look like? I mean, what is sort of, you know, real triumph translate to?
Initially, you need to have self-sustaining populations of American chestnut. If I put out 300 American chestnuts per acre and half of them survive and they start making chestnut babies, and then those chestnut babies make their chestnut babies, that's a self-sustaining population. That's success. And we don't know that we're going to see that for another maybe 100 years, because it takes a good 20 to 30 years to see natural regeneration in the landscape of these forest land plantings. I think it's doable. I think it's doable in the next, you know, 100 years that we'll start seeing that happen.
Why does it matter that we are able to save a species like the American chestnut?
The issue comes in forest diversity and sustainability and resiliency. And when you look at the health of a forest, particularly in the eastern United States, our entire ecosystem is based on a lot of different tree species working together to sustain the insect populations, the bird populations, the animal populations, even the fish populations. As you start to lose more and more trees, you start to lose that support system. So if you can save the American chestnut, restore that piece of food from the nuts, but also the leaves, the famous entomologist from the University of Delaware talks a lot about the connection of native plant species to native insect life, and that you'll see tens, if not hundreds of times of insects feeding on native plants over their non-native counterparts. And so while it's true that I can just plant Chinese chestnuts or Japanese chestnuts and get chestnuts, well, sure. But what they're not doing is feeding the native insects, which then feeds native birds, which then, you know, ripples throughout the ecosystem.
Yeah, it feels like the American chestnut's like one stone in the foundation of the house, right? And you can take it out and maybe you can live like that. But if you keep going and if you don't sort of address the problem that's breaking the foundation, the whole thing, at some point you reach a collapse and this is just sort of one piece. So we need tools to actually reverse some of that or address the problems.
Exactly. I'm really glad you made that analogy, because that's exactly what we're trying to do with the Chestnut Foundation.
If you want to help the mission of the American Chestnut Foundation, now anyone can participate. Use the Tree Snap app, and if you find a chestnut sapling, send it in. You'll be part of improving the resiliency of American chestnut trees and other threatened species. The mobile tool allows anyone to document and help scientists track American chestnut trees, along with other threatened species. Just take a picture on the app and tag it. This podcast is a co-production of Atlas Obscura and Witness Docs. Our production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Sarah Wyman,
Manolo Morales,
Chinenye Onike,
Maddie Weinberg,
Camille Mojica,
Tracy Samuelson,
John Delore,
Peter Clowney.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
Our theme and end credit music is by Sam Tyndall. This episode was mixed by
Luce Fleming.
And I'm Dylan Thuris, wishing you all the wonder in the world. I'll see you next time.
Witness Docs from Stitcher.
The world isn't wide enough for those with an insatiable desire for discovery. The all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid SUV offers the power and freedom to explore further and deeper than ever before. Intuitive, smart features ensure they are always connected to the road ahead. Inside, a thoughtfully designed cabin immerses you in a universe that is all your own. The larger-than-life panoramic display spans the entire width of the cabin. It's customizable and interactive. Drivers can even personalize their backgrounds with a series of nature-inspired themes. This vehicle signals the arrival of an exciting new chapter for Lincoln. Discover more about the 2024 Lincoln Nautilus at Lincoln.com.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Women Who Travel is a transported podcast for anyone curious about the world. We talk to adventurers and athletes.
I've raced the God's Own Adventure Race, which is on the South Island
and goes through the mountains down in the Southern Alps on New Zealand. That was 8 days spent out in the wilderness.
And chefs.
Iranian food is home, it's family, it's love.
And we share dispatches from our listeners.
Ireland is full of these, I will call them ghosts of the past.
From stampeding elephants to training sled dogs. We hear it all.
The dogs will curl right up with you, and it can be kind of cozy waiting things out.
New episodes of Women Who Travel publish every Thursday. Join us wherever you listen.